This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 254.
This podcast is brought to you by Google Play. Let me tell you something that may change your training forever, and that is listening to audiobooks while you run. It's amazing how they can take your mind somewhere else, and before you know it, miles and miles have gone by. So for a limited time, you can get $10 off your first audiobook by visiting g.co/play/MTA. That's g.co/play/MTA. Define your story with audiobooks on Google Play.
This episode is brought to you by Honest Tea. With great tasting, healthy USDA organic beverages, Honest Tea offers both a refreshingly transparent product and outlook. And now, to help you refuel after a tough workout, there's Honest Sport, the perfect everyday workout drink. To find out more, visit honesttea.com/podcast today. Honest Tea. Live actively, replenish organically.
This podcast is also brought to you by thenewkneeshop.com. New Knee is a revolutionary new product that can help you with that dreaded knee pain. It's available at newkneeshop.com. That's NUNEE shop.com. And our listeners can get a 20% discount when they use the code MTA20. Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where we inspire and empower you to go the distance. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we speak with Scott Jurek, legendary ultra runner who ran all 2,189 miles of the Appalachian Trail in 46 days. And for this episode's quick tip, we answer a listener question about what to consider when looking for the right pair of running shoes. And just a reminder that you can get all of our back podcast episodes and more with a membership to the Academy. Learn about that at MarathonTrainingAcademy.com. Well, we are still on the road. We're actually in Washington State now, having traveled from Pennsylvania many, many miles, over 1,000 miles. And I don't even want to think about the gas mileage that we've got pulling this camper trailer. But here we are on what we are calling Angie and Trev's most excellent adventure. So a quick travel update. Last time we podcast, we were still in Lewistown, Montana, where Angie's originally from. We left Lewistown and went to Billings for a few days to see our friends.
That's right.
Weather was hot in Billings, though, wasn't it?
It was a lot warmer than it had been previously. And we actually, you weren't with us, but we went up to the Rim Rocks in Billings and hiked around up there. And the kids had fun clambering on rocks and doing other daring things.
Yeah, I think hiking seems to be the theme of our travels so far. The next thing we did was go to Bozeman, Montana, and went on a hike up in the Bridger Mountains. And let me tell you what, this was not an easy hike. And we have, you know, little guys. We had our little niece and her dad, and our niece is 5. And then, of course, our son is 7. And we're hiking up this mountain where there's still snow, and there's these switchbacks, and sometimes you're crossing snow. And I'm thinking, man, I don't think my dad ever took me on a hike like this when I was 7.
Yeah, it was pretty intense. The wind was really strong in some areas. It was really cold up at the top. But it was just absolutely stunning up at the top. And if people are interested in seeing pictures of where we've been so far, they can follow us on Instagram at Marathon Academy.
That's right. After we left Montana, we drove to Washington State, where we are now. And on the way here to the Olympic Peninsula, we're actually near Port Townsend, Washington, where my parents live. But on the way here, we stopped at a couple campgrounds. But one that I think I'll always remember is this tiny little town called Vantage, Washington, right on the Columbia River. It's actually near George, Washington.
There's actually a town named that.
Yeah. I thought they were pretty clever when they named that town. It looks totally different than what they call the wet side of the state, Western Washington. So for those maybe they've never been to the state, you have the dry side east of the Cascades, and then you have the wet side west of the Cascades, you know, near the ocean where we are now. But both are just really beautiful in their own way, don't you think?
Yeah, it was really cool. Our campsite was literally just looking, we were so close on this bluff right next to the Columbia River. And then nearby, I took a run the next day, and there was something nearby called the Ginkgo Petrified Forest. And it was, you know, definitely a very desolate landscape, but, you know, beautiful in its own way. And there was a rock museum nearby, and our son was able to find some pieces of petrified wood on the beach, and it was a lot of fun.
It's been nice to take a morning run, you know, in a different place almost every day. and to see this amazing landscape. So, like I said, we're now in Western Washington on the Olympic Peninsula. We'll be doing a lot of outdoor-related stuff here, hopefully, and, of course, visiting with family and getting caught up on some work, which is what we're doing now with limited internet, which makes it hard.
That's right.
When all of your business is online. So that's a little update about our travels. Of course, Angie, have you realized yet that we haven't even begun the biggest leg of our travels? And to drive to Alaska, it's like driving from here to Florida. Do you realize that? Has that set in yet?
Sure it will at some point. There's no sense worrying about it now.
And of course, those that might not have heard, we are going to be at the Juneau Marathon in Alaska. That's why we're going up there. So if you're going to be there or have experience with the race, shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. We have a contact form on our website. Well, we're really excited to have Scott Jurek on the podcast today. We've been trying to get him as a guest for years, haven't we, Angie?
Yes, I think ever since we read his first book, Eat and Run, several years ago.
Yeah.
He's been one of our interview targets.
Yeah, I don't think he does many podcast interviews. He's a busy guy. I mean, he has no shortage of people knocking on his door trying to talk to him. So we were really excited to talk to him and to get his book, North. You might know of Scott from the Western States Endurance 100 Miler. Scott actually won Western States 7 times in a row back in the day. Speaking of Western States, this year was an historic year because Jim Walmsley won the race and set a course record. And he did so during just insane hot temps. You know, it was like 97 degrees at one point. Then it got up to like 106, like down in those canyons. So I don't know what this guy's made of, but he's somebody to watch, isn't he? Jim Walmsley. And the woman that won the race, Courtney DeWalter, I'm not sure if I said her last name right, she actually ran the second fastest time for a female. So, yeah, pretty exciting.
Yeah, that's astounding, especially based on how hot the temperatures were.
So before we jump into our interview with Scott Jurek and then our quick tip, Angie, we want to give some shout-outs to people in the community doing some awesome things, running races, kicking butt, taking names. What's going on out there?
That's right. We've got some great shout-outs. The first one is from Alicia Joe. She says, I did it. My first half marathon at the Foot Traffic Flat in Savi Island just outside Portland, Oregon.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that was one of our favorites. My training has been a little improvised because I was originally aiming for a fall marathon that got canceled. But I was able to maintain my goal pace of 11 minutes per mile the entire way and run it in at the end. Thank you so much, Trevor, Angie, and the MTA community for being my running community these past 9 months since I got the marathon bug. I'm so excited to keep going.
Well, that is awesome. Always love hearing about people's first marathon. You picked a really fun race, Alicia. We did that one, like Angie said, a couple years ago, and actually that's where Angie qualified for Boston, so it'll always have a special place in her heart.
That's right.
It's been fun having you in the academy. Alicia, keep up the great work.
This note comes from Christina. She says, Dear MTA, I recently completed my first marathon in Perth, Western Australia. I was so happy and emotional at the start line that I started to cry. I just couldn't believe that I was about to achieve my dream. Overall, the race went well until I hit a wall at the 37-kilometer mark, but I somehow pulled myself out and kept going. There were many tears of relief and happiness at the finish line, and I'm happy to say that I did it in 4 hours and 8 minutes.
Nice.
And I'm not too sore 2 days afterward. I don't have many people in my life that have caught the marathon bug, so if I hadn't stumbled on your podcast, I'm certain I wouldn't have learned about the training process properly or finished the race. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart.
Well, we're glad to be here for you, Christina. Great job on running your first marathon in Perth. It just sounds like you did a lot of things right. I mean, you pushed yourself through those hard miles, or I should say kilometers. You finished with a great time. Whatever you did, it worked.
That's right. This next note comes from Emily in the Academy. She says, The Big Five marathon is over, and I can honestly say it was the hardest physical thing I've ever done. There were sections where walking was the only option, and even walking was hard. But boy, was it beautiful. There was one point along the trail where a ranger with a rifle alerted me that the lion pride was in the bushes beside me and that he was monitoring them. With the walking in the deep sand, my time wasn't what I'd hoped for, and I ended up finishing in about 6 hours and 15 minutes. Thank you, MTA, for empowering me through this process, and especially to Coach Chris for getting me as prepared as possible for this race. It was a toughie, but 2 continents down, 5 to go.
She's got big goals.
I love it.
Wow. So when you're up there in Alaska and there's bears nearby, just think of Emily having to run with lions.
But she had a ranger nearby. I need a personal ranger to do the marathon with me, please.
We've actually had two coaching clients now in 2 years in a row train for the Big Five Marathon in South Africa. Of course, Big Five stands for the five types of animals, the five game animals that are on the reserve there that you can encounter. Hopefully not too closely, but you can encounter them.
This next note is from Rick in the Academy. He says, I recently finished the Rachel Carson Trail Challenge, which is a 36-mile primitive trail hike. The hills are crazy steep, and I finished in 11 hours and 32 minutes. This is an improvement over last year's time by an hour and 15 minutes. So I thought that was really cool that, you know, there's all kinds of challenges out there that your running fitness can prepare you for.
That's right, and that's in Pennsylvania. And I actually got to meet Rick at the Pittsburgh MTA meetup. He's a longtime Academy member. I got to meet him in person, though, and he was telling me about that trail race. Can you imagine that? 36-mile primitive trail.
Wow. This note is from Jody in the Academy. She says, so as many of you know, I signed up for MTA coaching 3 weeks ago. It's absolutely wonderful having timely feedback on training. I'm very impressed by the quality and thoughtfulness of the responses to my questions, and I've already filled the binder with the resources that Coach Krish has shared with me. I actually remember his words and advice while out on a training run, like having a coach right there. I feel very supportive. So just a general shout out to MTA coaching in general, and a very specific thank you to Coach Krish for such an amazing introduction to what coaching is all about.
All right. Love to hear it. Thank you so much, Jody, for the kind shout out about MTA coaching. Of course, we have 8 coaches on the team now and lots of runners in training for various challenges, whether it's to do their first marathon or do a faster marathon or BQ or just do more races injury free and pick up the wisdom that a coach can give. And we do have spots open at the moment. So if you are thinking about hiring a running coach and want to work with one of our amazing MTA coaches, you can check that out at marathontrainingacademy.com/coaching.
And this final note comes from Tammy. She says, I completed my first marathon recently at the Gold Coast Marathon in Australia. Thank you, everyone, for your encouragement along the way and for all the words of wisdom from Angie and Trevor on the MTA podcast. I love the whole experience and I'm already looking for my next event.
All right. Another Australian shout out there. Thank you, Tammy, for the feedback and congrats on running your first marathon. It's always an epic accomplishment. And the fact that you're looking to take on another one is a good sign.
That's right.
All right. So lots of good stuff. Congrats, everyone out there taking action in your health and fitness. We always love hearing from you. And this podcast exists to help you conquer that first marathon or subsequent marathon and just really make running a lifestyle. I know you're going to enjoy this interview with Scott Jurek. Like I mentioned earlier, he won the prestigious Western States 100-miler 7 times in a row back during the heyday of his career. But that's not all. He also won the Hard Rock 100, the Badwater 135, and the Spartathlon, which is a 153-miler in Greece. And he's a best-selling author. Some of you probably read his book, Eat and Run. Or is it Run and Eat? No, I think it's Eat and Run. It's a great book, though.
You won't be able to run unless you eat occasionally.
In 2015, Scott set the record for the FKT, the fastest known time, on the Appalachian Trail, covering all 2,189 miles in just 46 days. That's about 50 miles a day. Angie, you've run a 50-miler before. Can you imagine doing that for 46 days in a row?
No. And my 50-miler was a lot gentler than the Appalachian Trail, so I can't imagine. The most we've gone is a 17-mile stretch on it at one time, and that left me pretty beat up.
Yeah, actually, right before this trip, we went on a 17-miler together, and it was kind of... Was it a hot day? I don't remember.
No, it was actually really rainy, and the trail is extremely sloppy and wet and kind of unrunnable in sections.
But once you get to the mountains, I mean, there's not much running to be done because it's really rocky and just... Yeah, so every time I'm out there, I think, how can these people do this?
Yeah, I mean, having that experience just made reading his book, North, which he co-authored with his wife, Jenny... so much more impressive, because just imagining what he went through out there was a lot easier.
So the Appalachian Trail is often abbreviated AT. It's a hiking trail in the eastern part of the United States. It goes from the state of Georgia all the way up to Maine. It passes through 14 states, Georgia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. And it's one of the oldest hiking-only trails, so no horses are allowed on it, no vehicles. And like you're going to hear, it's just a rugged trail. It does go through a lot of towns. There's contact with civilization. But there are lots of sections of the trail where there's no cell service, there's no shelters, and it kind of feels like you're also a long ways from the long arm of the law, you know? Like, if something happens, it'd be a long time before anybody found you. And that was one of the challenges that Scott and his wife, Jenny, had. Jenny was his crew person, and they had a van that they were using. Actually, they have a nickname for the van. I think this is mentioned at least once in the interview. The nickname was Castle Black. And a couple other things just by way of introduction. Scott's going to mention Speed Goat. Speed Goat was a friend of his, Carl Meltzer, who was also a very accomplished ultra runner. And then you'll also hear Scott mention a guy named Horty, which stands for David Horton, who is a accomplished ultra runner. And you'll probably pick up on this easily, but Scott's wife is named Jenny, and she co-authored the book with him. And a little background, and they talk about this in the book, that they had some real difficulties with pregnancy and miscarriage. So Scott will kind of mention that, but they now have two kids. And in fact, when we did this interview, Scott was holding their newborn baby on his lap. And so he did the whole interview without the baby waking up. So I think that's all the introduction I think I need to make. You guys will pick up on the rest. Let's go ahead and get into our interview with ultra runner Scott Jurek, author of the book North, Finding My Way on the Appalachian Trail. Well on my way, well on my way. Okay, we're on the podcast now with Scott Jurek, author of the book North, Finding My Way While Running the Appalachian Trail. And he's also known as Super Dad, right, Scott?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I'm working towards that. I mean, definitely got a ways to go probably until I get that full title of Super Dad. But yeah, I've got my little 3-month-old here.
First guest we've had who's held a baby, a sleeping baby, while we've recorded. So
yeah, that's
right on, man.
No easy matter.
Well, thanks for being patient, and yeah, he should be totally out for the whole time, listening away.
Well, this is a great read, and I was just thrilled to see it come out because we live close to the Appalachian Trail, so like to have you write a book about setting the AT record and to be able to go along with you along the AT and hear about the different parts, it was just a lot of fun. So I recommend everyone getting the copy of the book North. But for folks that don't know who you are, can you maybe take us back to the beginning and how did you get started in ultra running?
Well, before I became an ultra marathoner, I was a hunting and fishing boy from northern Minnesota. And to be honest, I really didn't enjoy running. I dabbled in it, tried to do a little bit of junior high, ran a little bit of track, and I was decent at running, but I really didn't like it. And I just used it to get in shape for other sports. In fact, it was like my sophomore, junior year in high school when I was getting ready for the ski season that I needed to do something to stay in shape. My coach was like, well, you can roller ski, you can bike, you can roller blade and run. And the only option I really had, I couldn't afford any of the other modes of training, and running was my thing. So I just, you know, each day I would go out and, you know, go 2 miles down the road. And then next day, just kind of keep plugging away and just further and further. And by the end of the summer, I was running 8 miles at a shot. Again, it wasn't something I really didn't find a passion. I had all the problems, the side aches, the runner trots, you know, the things that everybody when they start gets into. But it really wasn't until I found trail running that running made more sense to me, or it seemed like something rather than, you know, drudgery or just kind of like, okay, you got to put in your hard work to stay in shape. It really struck a chord when I started finding trail running and realizing getting ready for ski seasons, following years, getting on the trails, and then running my first marathon a month later, running my first 50 miler. So it kind of just was this, resistant path to running, so to speak. It wasn't like I fell in love with it right away.
So what was it about trail running specifically that really resonated with you?
I think for me, it was being in the woods, something that I loved to do, hunting and fishing. And as a kid, I lived on the end of a dirt road 5 miles from town in the middle of, I wouldn't say nowhere, but there was no kids my age besides my brothers and sister. And it was being out in the woods was something I had to do because that was how I entertained myself. We'd build trails, build forts. And I think it was that love of being outside and being on the trails and the elements and just being so close to nature, I think that really struck a chord with me. And then, of course, the challenge of it, just, you know, seeing how far I could go and what I could do with the sport, even though I didn't have the gifts of a faster, shorter distance runner, because I definitely was not very good at the 5, 10 Ks and didn't really strike a chord until I got into that ultra realm. But I would say, yeah, the hunting and fishing background and just, a love for the outdoors and just being in the elements and kind of imagining that I was one of those wild animals that I used to love chasing in the woods. And we didn't have mountains in Minnesota, but we had plenty of hills and rugged country.
So you were on the trail, the AT, for 46 days. Did that love of nature stay with you the whole time, or did you get to the point where you're like, man, I'm sick of this?
Well, as you guys know, because you're how far from the AT?
We're about 5 miles.
Oh, you guys are. Oh,
Yeah,
you're
we're in
right
the
there.
Cumberland
Oh, that's so
Valley,
cool. Oh, okay.
Pennsylvania.
I remember that fondly. I had some of my.
Roxylvania.
Yeah, love. Actually, my best days were, and we can get on to that later, but yeah, I love that stretch. In fact, I had some huge days on that stretch and loved the rocks despite all the rumors and all the legends of how bad they were. I actually had some of my best days
Wow. Well,
were in
I want to go
Pennsylvania.
back. I want to unpack that. But did you ever get sick of being out on the trail?
Yeah, I like every, and I'll be really honest because I assume people think, oh yeah, top runners or people that, set records, they just are in love with every element of it. And there are times like everyone else where it's like, I wished I was back home on my couch or, just being able to take it easy and not being able to grind out another 50 miles each day. So there definitely were elements of that. But then there were the elements of even though I was struggling, even though I was in a lot of pain, discomfort mentally, I was just down and out. There were times when I can now see the joy in that. At the time, it might have been hard, but there were still elements of just being out in the woods, hearing the birds and, my knee screaming and my quad, sliced from a tear and just feeling like, there's still a beauty out here. And despite my predicaments and my adversities that I had to face with the struggle trying to set a record and trying to push today, there were still the little bits of joy. I remember one time and I was in the Tennessee, North Carolina border country. Injured and just really kind of giving up on the record at that point and just kind of wondering, how many more days am I going to continue? And I remember seeing all these red newts running along the trail and just kind of walking along. And I hadn't seen any of these before. And I was just fascinated with them. I just would, pick one up, let it crawl on my arm. And it was things like that, even though I was just in the depths of despair and feeling like, okay, the record's gone. There were still those moments when I could find like the beauty and the joy in the trail. So that's where I feel like there's still beauty and struggle. And Bane and I write about this in North that we just have to find it and have to be open to it. But it doesn't mean that there's not struggle and that there's not difficult moments. Because I think some people assume that, okay, it's always going to be this pure joy. You're always going to want. But for me, part of the reason I did something like this is I wanted to find the joy in running that I felt like I just wasn't quite finding, and I didn't have that passion and drive that I had in my earlier years, and that was something that rediscovering it was really important.
I like it. So, what is the allure of the Appalachian Trail?
Well, it's one of the most iconic trails, and for me, I had only been on 20 miles of it, and I think that's that complete newness. I had a lot of exploratory runs out west. I'd spent a lot of time on the Pacific Crest Trail, being close to Seattle, dabbled in the Colorado Trail and Continental Divide Trail. But the Appalachian Trail was completely new, and that's what I really loved about it. Jenny was really excited too, because we hadn't been through some of the states that it even crossed. We just were enamored with the history too. I had several books on the Appalachian Trail, have friends who have done it. Anytime I was out east, I would try to, just see where the Appalachian Trail crossed, maybe get a few miles on it. And there's something about it. It's a really interesting combination of nature, rugged mountains, and also the social aspect and the history behind the trail. It's just the through hiking community and culture. If you're looking to, I guess, get away from everything, the Appalachian Trail probably isn't the most secluded wilderness setting, but
You can hear traffic,
that's
from
yeah, you can hear traffic, and
lots of
I think
crossings.
it's really real, and that's what I loved about it. The going through the trail towns and feeling connected to the communities and the other users of the trail, the other through hikers, and spending time with them and the shelters. And because it is our oldest national scenic trail, I know the Long Trail is slightly older, but as far as one of the big long distance trails in the US or the one of the longest, it's one of the oldest, and so it has so much history behind it too. And going through the East Coast and all the history that original states, you really feel that, and there's a lot to it. And I think that was the beauty too. Now, for people who are just drawn to the sheer ruggedness, the AT, for those who know nothing about the Appalachian Trail, it's probably one of the most rugged footpaths on the planet because it's foot travel only. There's no horse pack. The switchbacks aren't graded for, they weren't old mining roads or they weren't old railroad beds. So, while you do step on a road from time to time, it's just really rugged. And as you mentioned earlier, a state like Rocksylvania has a lot of history with and maybe and lore with it as well, where people say, the Pennsylvania trail clubs actually dump more rocks on the trail with wheelbarrows than they actually remove and make it smoother. So
yeah,
I think
that.
The trail clubs and the history behind it, and just everyone wants to make their section a little bit harder and a little nastier. And I think that's what, whether it's true or not, it's just fun to have those kind of traditions. Whereas I think on the Pacific Crest Trail and the Continental Divide Trail, you get more of this sense of like you're just way out there, you're way out in wilderness. Whereas the AT is really connected to the communities and the people that are involved with the trails.
It is rugged. I mean, to me, it just seems unrunnable. Just ankle twisty, rocks everywhere. And you were doing 50 miles a day, so you had to, I guess you had to go about 3 miles an hour, right?
Yeah, it's really my buddy Speed Goat, who I describe quite vividly in the book. He came out for 2 weeks and helped us. And then, of course, I went out and helped him the following year when he went after the record. And I won't spoil anything for anybody who hasn't read it. But he always used to say, like, just get on the AT treadmill and go 3.5 miles an hour. And for those that have never been on the AT, one of the other things that it's known for is being this green tunnel. And it can be very monotonous at times because you have the canopy overhead. It's just green from the trail up, from all the undergrowth. And a lot of times you just got to put your head down, and it may seem monotonous and it may seem like you've been in this spot for hours. And you're just, going up and down these mountains, but you do get reprieve sometimes, like in the Cumberland Valley. You have these nice flat stretches, where you're going through the fields. And I remember that morning, I must've had probably, 10, 15, 20 people joining me. The local trail clubs and hiking and running came out, and it was just a blast. But I remember those stretches where I actually made really good time because it got more mellow through the farm fields. And then, like you said, going up north and south mountain, you're back in the rocks and it just, gets rugged. But the average, is about 3.5 miles an hour in terms of trying to set a record. So I wasn't blazing the trail, so to speak. And as you mentioned, it's not hospitable to running a lot of times. I might have been running maybe 40, 50, so at times 60% of the day, just because it is so rugged. And there are times, sure, when I get a good stretch where I could go 6 minute pace or 7 minute pace downhill. And then other times, it's just a slog of 2-3 miles an hour because you're just trudging through rock beds and technical terrain.
That's been my experience.
Yeah. Well, that's what's so funny. All the locals would tell Jenny and I, because we'd be like, so what's the next section like? Or Jenny would try to get beta on people, like, okay, so what should he expect, when I want to give him a little pep talk when he comes in? And people would be like, oh, we never actually run on the Appalachian Trail. This isn't really where we like to run. So nobody really trains on the Appalachian Trail for running. So it was kind of funny. In fact, some people who lived an hour away who came on the trail or 2 hours away, they're like, I've never been to the Appalachian Trail before. So if you're listening to this and you're at all close to the Appalachian Trail, make an effort to get out there. You don't have to run, but even hiking on it, it's really a national treasure, amazing footpath.
Look down at the path and say, Scott Jurek passed right through here.
That's right.
Yeah, a few years ago.
So your wife, Jenny, was your main support system, involved in a lot of the logistics of it, and you guys kind of were based out of a van. You kind of talk about how logistically challenging it was. I mean, she had to drive like in the middle of nowhere to try to find you. That sounded really mind-boggling to me.
Definitely. She's a good sport, and she loves the mountains, loves the outdoors. She's a tough mountain girl, even though she grew up in the suburban Bay Area. Was somebody who I couldn't have done this without. In fact, when we wrote the book, it was apparent that we had to weave in her story. And so those of you who haven't read the book yet, she tells the story from her side at the end of each chapter and weaves into the stories that were happening on the trail. So not only was she a good sport, but she was very good at what she did. She only missed me, I think, twice the whole journey. So if you can imagine the hundreds of road crossings that she had to find, times where the trail just comes out, and you guys know about this, even in your neck of the woods where it might seem a little bit more developed, or there's, a lot more pavement that crosses the Appalachian Trail, it's still finding this tiny little, it's not like they put up huge signs at every road
No,
crossing.
and it's not
Some
like good
road
parking.
crossings. Yeah. Exactly. And so it's like this tricky balance of, how do you find this tiny little ribbon of trail as it, crosses this road? And she got really good. And again, our buddy Horty and Speed Goat, they were blown away with her map reading skills. And she likes to joke about it that she's like, yeah, I bet you didn't think an Asian American female driver could drive like this and find things and not get lost. So she likes to joke. But it really, again, as daunting and at times, it was, scary for her to be alone. We really wanted to do this journey on our own, have friends come out occasionally, but really just spend some time. I think it was finding that balance. And she had the tough job of like, okay, now where am I going to find laundry? Every 4, 5, 6 days when the clothes got unbearable, and she just couldn't stand it anymore. And finding food and gas up the van, and somehow occasionally log onto the internet and get messages out to people because she was stuck out in the middle of nowhere with no signal down in the valleys, and the river bottoms or creek bottoms where the trail would come in with a road, and there would be no reception. I'd sometimes have better reception because I'm up on a ridge line and connected. So it was really this fine balance of there was really no communication and ability to say, oh yeah, I'm running late, or she would just have to sit there and wait and hope that I would come across. And she writes about that in, I think, a very unique way in the book, and just giving her opinion of like, we all sat and waited and hoped our runner or our competitor in whatever sport it is finally makes their way to where we're waiting for them and crewing for them. But it's a huge job, and she, I would have to say, her job was way harder than I just had to follow those white blazes and that tiny little ribbon of trail, and she had to find me out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Living in a small van too. I mean, that's the thing. You have to be a good sport when you're
That's a real
crammed
test of a
into this,
marriage.
tiny little. And I know it's we write about this as well, like challenging a relationship. I don't think there's much more you could do in terms of putting it to the test, and just living in this cramped quarters. We had a twin bed basically in the back that we had rigged up, and had a little counter for a stove. It wasn't really posh living, so we always laughed when people would be like, "Oh yeah, he's got this fancy van, and his sponsors, gave him this fully rigged RV van." But it was pretty bare bones. It was very basic living, and but it also had some comforts that we really enjoyed and just really were appreciative for. And so it was a lot of fun, despite all the tough things about it.
And there were definitely moments of doubt when you weren't sure if you were going to make the record, but it seems like Jenny would not let you quit.
I mean, that's the other task she had too, is anybody who's, whether you actually go out to an event and support a partner or spouse or loved one or friend or family, it's hard to be also that motivator. And she was able to do that job as well, on top of all the other logistical things she had to do. She also had to give me that tough love of like, you know what, you got to put in another, 15, 18 miles tonight. And there were times when it was like, she didn't want to like send me off when it was just, dumping rain and thunder and lightning all over, and it just would seem like, oh man, he's in so much pain right now. But she also knew how to just, motivate me and say like, get out there and get it done. And that's where I think having that combinations of her and friends that would come out, you have to be able to watch somebody who you care about suffer and tell them, you know what, go out and suffer some more. And that's a hard position to be in, because you naturally want to like help them, you want to comfort them. And she had that really good balance of, nurturing me, but at the same time saying, you know what, this is what you came for. I mean, I often use that mantra. Those who
I
read my
like
first
that.
book, it's like, no one was making me do this. It was something that Jenny and I chose to do. And when there were times when we were just, feeling like defeated, and I told her at one point, let's just go home. This is stupid. It's pushing us, too far. I just saw her being pushed to her edge, and I was at the end of my rope, and it felt like, this is just stupid. Let's go home. And then she was like, no way, we're not going home now. We're too close. So it's really that fine balance. And I think it's a good place to test a relationship. I'm not recommending everyone go and do 2,200 miles on the Appalachian Trail, but doing something where you watch and have to support your loved one. And sometimes that's just from at home in terms of a passion they have or their occupation or whatever challenge they're trying to meet in life. You know, it's finding that, you know, that balance and knowing like how to be supportive, yet how to be motivating.
When was the first time when you kind of sank to that spot of thinking, well, I don't know if I'm going to be able to make the record. Let's just go. And you really felt just beat up by the trail. Was it in Georgia or Tennessee? Was it that early on in the journey?
It was a week in only. And that's where.
Wow. So you're still in Georgia probably, or maybe in Tennessee.
Oh, no, actually. So we were in, at that moment, we were in Tennessee. And so we were kind of like jumping, you kind of cross over the North Carolina and Tennessee border a bunch of times. You're just kind of like following that imaginary border. The AT actually is right on the state lines of those two states. And it was really, it wasn't supposed to, like, I knew the injuries were going to happen, but, you know, they would typically do happen in that first week or two, but I just didn't think it would be that bad. And I didn't think I'd have two injuries, basically a torn quadricep on my left side, because I was compensating for a right knee chondromalacia patella, or what most people know as runner's knee. And so the patellofemoral pain was just, you know, so much that I started compensating, and then coming out of the Smokies and the rugged downhills, I just ripped my quad. And now it just seemed like everything was over, and it was, you know, raining three times a day. The trail was just so muddy, so wet. I mean, just everything seemed to be going wrong. And that's when my buddy Horty came out. And he actually came at a really critical time in convincing us that, no, we gotta keep going and just see if my body can heal itself as I keep going. And it was a really interesting part.
How does your body heal if you're still running 50 miles a day?
Well, you don't run for a couple of days like I did. And that was the big thing, is I needed to decrease the stress to it. So I was trying to find that fine line between overstressing an injury and letting it recover while still putting miles on my legs and getting down the trail. Because if I had taken a day off or two, I probably wouldn't have been that much better off. Like, I might've had a little less pain, but it probably would have came back. And B, you take a day or two off and now you could just pretty much kiss the record goodbye, even though I was only a week in. And one might say, well, you can make up. But if you can imagine making that up by having to do, you know, say 52 mile days instead of, you know, 48 or 49 mile days, those 3 miles each day are another hour on the trail. And I was coming in at times already at 11 o'clock at night. So if you can imagine each day you're having to go a little longer, and in some states, 3 miles can take you more than an hour. So it just really was starting to come down to looking like it wasn't going to happen. But at the same time, I was just giving it a shot. If I could decrease the stress to it, put more load through my poles, try and hobble and limp, even though I had two bad legs and couldn't do that anymore. It was a matter of just, you know, finding a way to decrease the stress, icing constantly at night. I even hiked with an ice pack on my knee, which I know seems contraindicated when you're moving, you shouldn't be icing something, but it was just, how can I minimize or decrease the inflammation so at some point it could turn the corner? And then each day I just ran a little bit more. So by not running and just walking, literally for one day was 37, 38 miles. The next day was 40 miles. And then by the third day I was running, you know, a little segment of that, you know, 50 miles, and just each day trying to plug into more running miles as much as I could. And the beauty of the AT, it doesn't let you run as much. So thankfully it wasn't something that I was losing tons of time on. Just by walking at 3 miles an hour, I could still maintain a record pace, but it was making the days a lot longer as well.
I think you guys did a really good job of just detailing the nitty gritty of what it took. You know, the rigors of the trail in itself, you know, you talked a lot about how much it rained and the mud. And then just also, you know, trying to keep up your calories so that your body stays strong. There was the sleep deprivation, of course, your injuries. It was like painful to read at points because it was like, wow, I just cannot imagine, you know, how you're having to overcome all of that mentally. You mentioned, you know, some key friends who came in during points of your journey. What was that like in kind of helping you physically and emotionally to give you that support?
What exactly did they tell you that stuck with you?
Well, like you mentioned, we probably didn't, like, strategy wise, we could have, this is where my buddy Speed Goat Carl Meltzer was like, dude, first of all, you're going backwards. When I talked to him, even before we set foot on the trail, we were driving out to Georgia, and I actually hadn't talked to him because I know he had dedicated probably a good chunk of his career and life to the Appalachian Trail, and he had tried twice to set the record, and I didn't really want to mine him for information because I've always, you know, even as a friend, just respected all the work and effort he's put into it. So I didn't want to, you know, steal any of his info, and he was just shocked that I hadn't talked to him beforehand. And the other thing, he was like, well, you're going backwards, you should be going southbound, and most of the record attempts had been southbound. So right off the bat, we weren't listening to maybe some of the advice, but we kind of had this goal of like, we're going to use advice and help from our friends, but Jenny and I wanted to do things on our own, I guess, terms, but also just with our own, like the things that mattered most to us. Like, I wanted to go north, and thus the title of the book, because I wanted to hike with the other through hikers instead of going backwards and, you know, just seeing them pass the other direction. I always had this vision of, you know, going up north with spring and summer. And even though I was moving at a faster rate, I wasn't able to, you know, follow the protocol by Earl Schaefer, the first through hiker to go from north to south and complete the trail. But it still had this allure to it of like, even though it might be a little slower, not maybe the best strategy. So from our friend's standpoint, they were super helpful because once they came out, Speed Goat in particular spent 2 weeks with us. Hordy came out. Actually, I think he came out three times, a couple times to deliver stuff and quick trips. But he came out at key moments where he had the experience. You know, Carl had the experience of being on the trail. And just even though they couldn't take away my pain, they couldn't take away the struggle, they could help me a little bit, maybe reorient or maybe kind of mind twist my thinking a little bit in terms of just getting me to think a little bit more positively, or to kind of put me in that motivational. And there's at one point where Hordy just simply tells me, this is who I am and this is what I do. And
I remember that.
It was like, it was just a simple and kind of, with Hordy, as I mentioned in the book, he's one of these guys who comes up with great wisdom, and sometimes he can be completely annoying with his philosophies. And he came up with that, and it really didn't hit me until a little bit down on the trail, where it's like, okay, I got to really distill things down to the basics right now. Like, I can't overthink. I can't be in my head about like how much time I'm losing on the AT right now with these injuries and the record. It really just got to, I just need to think about, okay, this is who I am, this is what I do. I try to put in 50 miles a day and just keep plugging away and tune out the things that don't matter, and just try to remember that, you know, this is why I'm out here. I'm out here for that. And Speed Goat had like the simple wisdom I mentioned earlier. He'd be just like, just get on the AT treadmill and run 3.5 miles an hour. So he was very just cut and dry. Like there wasn't any like, you know, sage wisdom to his advice, but it was always, you know, just very, yeah, like, why are you thinking that way? Just, this is what you do. And so we needed like that combination of, you know, my buddy Hordy, who had that kind of like prophet type wisdom, to, you know, my buddy Speed Goat, who is just suck it up, dude, and get out there and get it done. So I think that was that interesting twist. And then I had Jenny, who as a partner and spends so much time with me and really knows how I tick, like she needed to give me that comfort and that nurturing element as well. So it's just really that combination, right? And then the people who came out, the strangers, like I had to put a lot of trust in strangers, people I'd never met before, to do things, to get me through tough stages, to go through the night. I had two guys join me. I'd met them literally on the trail before we set off. And wow. Jenny's like, these guys are going to join you tonight. And it really added an interesting element. And then all the people that came out, and the simple, you know, just motivational, like, hey, keep going, or, you know, the signs. I remember in the Cumberland Valley at different stops, you know, people came out and they had like these life-size caricatures of different individuals, and I think some of them were George Washington. I just remember there was this wild group of people, and they were just way into it. And then there were other times, you know, people that told me their stories about how they had just recovered from cancer and they were going to join me for 30 miles that day and run an ultramarathon with me. And so as it was to have the elements of people coming out on the trail, and as much as a strain on Jenny at times, it just added a new twist and a new perspective for me. And actually, sometimes it was just those simple things that got me going each day and kept me going each day.
So Let's think about maybe what people can get from our conversation. Like when they're out there, we have a lot of folks that run marathons, but we have some ultra folks too. And when they're out there and the going gets tough and they're too much in their own head, I wonder what we could share for folks to keep pushing themselves. One thing I'm going to think next time, if Scott can run 2,200 miles on the trail, I can run this marathon.
Exactly. And it's true. I think you're hitting on a key point. It's a great segue into this because I've just mentioned it was like perspective. People gave me perspective. So one of the key things I would encourage, and I think for a lot of people who are, say, half marathoners, marathoners, and think, oh, this ultra thing is really for nut jobs or for people that are really out there. But it's all different perspectives. And mm-hmm. just because, I love when people say, well, I only do, marathons. I'm like, it's 26 miles. That's a lot of miles. You shouldn't be using the word only.
Right.
Or, I only run a half marathon. But it's really about perspective. And like you mentioned, for some people, it's motivating, like, oh, if somebody can do that, I can get through this. And that's where I would be reminded, like the gentleman who said he wanted to join me for 30 miles. And first of all, I was like, oh man, 30 miles. Like, I don't even know this guy. And now I'm going to be spending like most of my day with him. But, then the next thing he said is I survived leukemia this spring. And I told myself after I get through my last treatment, I'm going to run an ultra marathon with you. And
wow.
He had told himself that and how powerful that is. And so like you mentioned perspective of like, I was thinking, I can't complain about my blisters or how bad my feet hurt or my injuries. This guy was like me. He was my age. He had a family, had children. And it was just really, it just put me in a whole different trajectory mentally. And I think that's important for people is when things get tough, having perspective like that of thinking like, okay, I can get through the next 5 miles or I can get through the next mile. Breaking the sometimes impossible goal into small pieces really helps. And so when I was out on the trail, sometimes it was focused, okay, get to this next mountaintop or get to the next road crossing. And road crossings were always great landmarks because like hearing the traffic, you're like, okay, I finally made it through that next 6-7 mile section. The same can be done in marathons or half marathons or in training runs of just breaking the larger goal into smaller pieces. And then putting a perspective on things. I think one of the best things somebody can do, because we all suffer despite what everyone thinks. Like some people think, oh, I'm never going to feel pain. Like we're all going to have a low point, especially in a marathon,
mm-hmm.
maybe not a half marathon, but you get into those low points and sometimes breaking the goal down or trying to correct your nutrition or your hydration isn't going to help. The only thing that can sometimes help is offering up that struggle and that suffering that you're enduring at the moment. And whether it's for somebody else or for a cause, I would constantly think about Jenny and the struggles that she had gone through and all the procedures and the tests and the miscarriages and just almost dying on our kitchen floor. And I just would remember all that she had been through and think to myself, okay, I can get through this. Like, this isn't really that bad. It hurts and it's probably some of the worst pain I've had, but if Jenny got through that, I can do this. And like my mother who had MS for 30 years, she was stripped of just being able to do simple things at the end, like swallowing and not being able to push buttons on a remote control, all the things that we take for granted. So I think it's important to have an intention or an offering and just think about somebody or something that you can kind of offer up that struggle for, because there's always somebody who has it way worse than we do. And the crazy thing is we voluntarily want to do marathons and ultra marathons or do the Appalachian Trail. And again, we go there because we intend, I think, to suffer, and it's getting through the suffering. And that would be my best advice to everyone is put yourself in an uncomfortable position, like that marathon, that half marathon, or maybe that first run around the block and you haven't been running in years or ever run in your life, and embrace that struggle, because that's why we're there. We're there to learn from it. And as maybe messed up as that sounds, I think in the end, that's what makes us better individuals. And we come out of those experiences transformed.
Yeah, I think that's excellent. Like you said, there is so much suffering in life that we can't control. And then, we choose as runners to put ourselves through that suffering, and it's something that we can do, whereas a lot of other people can't. And just having that, like you said, it's all about perspective, and that's really powerful.
Definitely.
And Scott, if folks want to learn more about you, where should I send them online?
either they can go to my website, scottjerk.com, or I'm on all forms of social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. And yeah, I'm looking forward to the next big adventure. Now I've got, you know, two little ones, and Jenny will have a full Castle Black, the van, next time around. So it'll be
it'll be a
whole nother element having little ones along for a big adventure run. But yeah, we're really excited, and you know, thanks to everyone, to any of your listeners who followed along. It was really really important to receive those messages and the support along the way. It really was an amazing journey, and we couldn't have done it without everyone's support and passion for running. It was really neat to experience that on a whole different level.
Fantastic. We will let you go.
That's good. And your little guy was perfect. So
yeah, hopefully you guys are listening for the background noise. But yeah, only one time did he like stir, but he really didn't make much noise. So
we've had like barking dogs in the background and stuff like that before.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
okay.
Like lawnmowers and like.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
little people are always
there. Was leaf blowers.
Okay. Exactly. And construction workers are home. Well, great. Well, it was a pleasure talking to you guys.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize you guys were in Pennsylvania. I guess when I look up the stuff on different podcasts, I didn't really realize you guys. Where you guys were located, but it's awesome. Well, say hello to the Cumberland Valley for me and all the runners out there. Like I said, they came out. It was really something that one day a lot of days in Pennsylvania, but especially that day. I know we started from Boiling Springs because we slept in the parking lot of the ATC headquarters there, the regional headquarters.
Yeah, I love Boiling Springs.
And headed north on the trail from there. So yeah, we had a bunch of people come out that day. It was a lot of fun.
The final parking lot before you get to North Mountain, and that's where I like to get on. I don't know if you remember that spot or not.
Yeah. I kind of do. Like, Jenny will remember more of the names and stuff because she had to like drive, and I just was like, oh, this is another parking lot.
Yeah. But once you get up North Mountain, there's a rock bench, and you can see across the valley all the way to South Mountain.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember Carl telling me, it was wicked hot that day. We had one thunderstorm, but it was super hot. I remember going through Dunn Canyon, it was like 90 some degrees and just like wicked humidity. Yeah. And I do remember, and Carl was just like, dude, the rattlesnakes are so huge on North and South Mountain. And he was, and I never saw any, cause I was always, you know, excited to like see these monster rattlesnakes in Pennsylvania. But Carl always told me, and that actually was my 59 mile day. Cause I went on. So when you were reading in the book, just to give a perspective, whatever that trailhead is on the other side of that mountain, and you drop to the next road crossing, was where, you know, Carl basically speed goat tells me, you know, got to do another, I think he said 18 or 15 that night.
Wow.
And it was already almost 8 p.m. So, and then I went all the way, I think it's like Green School Road or something like that, or Green Point School Road.
Yeah.
So anyways, to give you guys perspective, that was right in your neck of the woods then.
Okay.
Wow.
So, awesome.
So, yeah.
I'm glad it's stuck in your mind then.
Yeah. Good times in Pennsylvania. Like I said, I have no bad dreams about Pennsylvania, despite Carl always, he hated Pennsylvania. Maybe his attitude has changed since he set the record, but he always had a tough mental spot in Pennsylvania with the rocks and just everything, beating up his feet. So
glad we can be here for him.
Exactly. Well,
right.
Awesome. Well, you guys take care. Keep up the great work on the podcast.
And yeah, thanks so much.
We'll see you somewhere at some marathon or at some event at some point.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'll say hi.
Okay.
Take care.
Take care, guys.
Bye.
We'll see you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that conversation with Scott Jurek. Now we'd like to get into this episode's quick tip. We're going to answer a question about how to choose the right pair of running shoes. Before we do that, we'd like to thank our episode sponsors who make it possible for us to do what we do. Big thanks to New Knee. If you've been struggling with pain in your knees during runs, definitely take a look at New Knee. It's helping lots of runners, and it's received a 5-star rating from physical therapy doctor Ben Chateau, who we've had on the podcast.
The New Knee was designed by 2-time Ironman and engineer Mike Emmerling. He had struggled with runner's knee for years, and he had tried a variety of compression sleeves and straps, but nothing allowed him to run without pain. So he came up with his own solution that he calls New Knee, and he now trains knee pain free and no longer modifies his training to accommodate knee pain. In fact, he just sent along some feedback from an MTA customer named Sarah, and she said, I was recently diagnosed with patellofemoral condymalacia, basically runner's knee. It's made running quite painful and several tears have been shed. I'm a marathoner and I can't even run 1 mile right now. My parents bought me the new knee brace and my knee felt immediately better while wearing it. Mike checked back in with her to see her results and she said, "It's wonderful. I'm back to running again and couldn't be happier. Thank you." And of course, that's the reason that Mike created Noonie to help others just like him. So you can check out Noonie at the noonieshop.com. That's N-U-N-E-E shop.com. And you can use the code MTA20 to receive a 20% discount.
That's right. And you also get the Resilient Runner program, which we sell on our website to help combat injury. You'll get that complimentary with your purchase of the Noonie as kind of a gift from us. So that's noonieshop.com and use the code MTA20. We'd also like to thank our friends at Health IQ for sponsoring this episode. Of course, we shouldn't take life for granted, as we all know, but thankfully there is affordable life insurance. And the good news about Health IQ is they even secure lower rates for health-minded people like runners.
That's right. Just like you can save money on your car insurance by being a good driver, Health IQ helps you save money on your life insurance for living a health-conscious lifestyle. Of course, these savings are exclusive to Health IQ and you must qualify to get the special rate. You can qualify for up to 33% savings by using one or more of the following methods. You can take a Health IQ quiz and score elite, and we did help develop the marathon quiz. You can also show screenshots from your activity tracking apps like Strava, Runkeeper, Nike Plus, Garmin, Map My Ride, or Map My Run. For runners, if you run at least 10 miles a week, or if you're a cyclist, you cycle at least 50 miles a week, you can qualify. So to see if you qualify and get a free quote on life insurance, visit healthiq.com/MTA. That's healthiq.com/MTA.
We'd also like to thank Knipe for sponsoring this episode. Knipe is a plant-based solution to your self-care needs. They, in fact, have been creating plant-based vegan products for the last 125 years. And you know what? I don't think we even mentioned that Scott Jurek is a vegan. Okay. And we had no time to talk to him about that because we had so many other things we wanted to ask him.
Knipe products are dermatologist tested and recommended. They're cruelty-free, paraben-free, and do not contain any preservatives, paraffins, or silicone and mineral oils. All products are processed gently and tested comprehensively to ensure optimal efficacy and skin tolerance. They offer a wide variety of products like mineral bath salts, herbal bath oils, foot care, and more. And personally, I like to know that the ingredients in my products, whether I'm eating them or putting them on my skin, are going to be safe and not cause any physical side effects. So for 15% off your first order, go to Knipe.com and use the promo code MTA at checkout. That's Kneipp.com and use the promo code MTA for 15% off your first order.
All right, well, now it's time for this episode's quick tip. We got a great question from Vince. He said, "Hi, Angie and Trevor. I'm running my first full marathon in about a month. I wanted to know if you had any specific suggestions for running shoes. I would like some cushion to prevent soreness in my feet. Looking forward to your reply." And we actually get a lot of questions about shoes and shoe recommendations, and we've been, you know, reluctant to recommend a certain pair. Maybe you'll talk about why. So let's talk about running shoes, Angie. What can you tell us?
Yes, we definitely do have some specific suggestions in choosing running shoes. And like you said, Trevor, this is a question that we get a lot through our contact page. And so I wanted to give a few guidelines. And like you mentioned, there is no one-size-fits-all brand or model of running shoes. So even if we did have a running shoe company sponsoring us, you know, there's not one particular pair we can point to and say, everyone go get this pair of shoes. It's going to be great, you know.
It's going to meet all your needs all the time.
That's right. And actually, you know, for some people, finding their soulmate, as a lady named Katie in the Academy said, soul as in S-O-L-E.
I like that.
Soulmate.
Clever.
It can be very challenging, while some people don't seem to have any trouble at all. You know, so if you're one of those people who can pretty much wear any brand of shoes and comfortably run in them, you're very blessed. But for a lot of people, it can be very challenging. And when you choose your running shoes, you really just can't go with some shoe that your friend recommends or a color scheme that you like. You know, there's a lot of wrong ways to pick your running shoes. There are some good suggestions that we have. The first thing is to make sure that any shoes you wear for a race, especially a marathon, have already been tested and broken in with at least a couple long runs and are comfortable. It's never fun to be in the midst of a marathon and be dealing with uncomfortable rubbing, pinching, or numbness. Mm. All those things are not good. So I recommend starting to break in a new pair of shoes at least 2 to 3 weeks before you're ready to retire the current pair that you're wearing. So start to integrate the new pair of shoes into your rotation before your old shoes have given up the ghost. The second thing I'd recommend is that you understand what your foot type is like. So foot types can be divided into three general categories, which measures the height of your arch. So there's a high arch, normal arch, and there's a flat arch or a flat foot. And you can do a simple test at home called the paper bag test to get a general view of what your arch type is like. So you just lay a flat piece of the paper bag on the floor, you wet the bottom of your foot, and you step on the bag, and then look at the imprint to determine whether your foot has a high, normal, or a flat arch. And if you kind of want some pictures to compare it to, you can Google the paper bag test and compare your footprint to what you see online. And that kind of gives you a pretty good determination. The next thing we'd recommend is to go to a specialty running store and get your foot and gait evaluated before you commit to a new shoe brand or a shoe model. If you can find a knowledgeable employee at the specialty running store, they can really help you understand if you have issues with overpronation. And that's the way your foot rolls in on the landing and pushing off stage of your stride. So ideally, they should be able to give you a few shoes to try on within the range for your foot and the needs that you have for the shoe. So if you're going to be running a bunch of trails, you'll probably want a trail shoe. If your marathon's on roads, you'll want a road shoe. You know, the type of cushioning that you want, or if you want a minimalist shoe, there's a lot of different models out there for all those types of needs. And don't be afraid to wear the shoe around the store for a few minutes and even run in them a bit before purchasing. And you should make sure that there's about a thumb's width of room between the end of your toes and the end of the shoe, and that you have plenty of room in the toe box. So you don't want your running shoes to feel like they're squeezing your toes. You don't want your toe to bump up against the end. You don't want it to feel tight and constrictive. Because your feet swell as you run, and the longer you run, the more your feet are going to swell. And if the shoe is already too snug or too tight, it's going to cause a lot of compression and problems.
Like black toenails.
Black toenails, blisters, possibly numbness or nerve discomfort. So, yeah. And it also helps if the running store is a good return policy if the shoe doesn't work out for you. The next thing I'd recommend is to be cautious about making any drastic adjustments in the type of the shoe that you're wearing without taking necessary time to transition. What I mean by that is that if you make changes in the type of cushioning or support or the heel to toe drop right before a marathon, it could really give you some bad results. You don't want to just change things up right before you do a race. You want to do some training runs in them to make sure that they're going to work for you. For example, for years, my training and marathon shoe was the ASICS Nimbus. Now, they're a highly cushioned neutral shoe with a heel to toe drop of 10 millimeters. That's basically the differential between the height of the heel and the height of the toe.
And when you say neutral, you mean what?
I mean that my foot doesn't overpronate. I don't have a stiff foot where, you know, it doesn't move at all, but I don't have a lot of overpronation.
Okay.
So, however, they introduced a new model, like happens to many people, and so the shoe suddenly didn't work for me, and so I began searching for a new shoe. And this led me to try more minimalistic styles. I tried Vibrams, Scora, Topo, Ultras, a lot of those different shoes, but it took me several months before I was able to wear a zero drop shoe for long runs and marathons. It's something that you don't want to rush. You don't want to risk potential injury, especially a lot of people develop calf issues or Achilles tendon issues if they switch the drop of their shoe too rapidly.
We've heard stories, you know, especially when the book Born to Run came out, which really champions barefoot running and minimalism. And so people were going out and they were buying Vibrams. So they went from like a cushiony shoe to running 10 miles in Huarachas or Vibrams and boom, developed an injury.
Yeah, your body needs time to adjust. If you've been running in a highly supportive, highly cushioned shoe, the support structures in your foot aren't ready for a looser, more minimalistic approach. So you really need to take time for that to allow your foot to strengthen. Now my go-to marathon shoe is the lightweight zero drop Ultra Escalante. But it's something that, you know, my shoe has changed over the years, and I'm sure in 5 years I could be wearing a totally different shoe. So it's something that once you find your shoe, don't be too rigid in that because it's going to change over time.
That's why we stockpile, right?
We do know some people who stockpile shoes because just when you find like your shoe, it seems like then they introduce a new version of it, and sometimes they change things and all that good stuff.
It's like the iPhone, always a new version to sell to the masses.
That's right. So if you're interested in finding out what the current heel to toe differential or the drop of your current shoes are, you can, you know, Google it, look online. Most of the places who sell running shoes will include it in a description. So if you're currently in a shoe with a drop of 10 millimeters. Don't go out and buy a zero drop shoe and expect to use it for a marathon in, you know, a month or two, because that's probably not the wisest course of action. Another thing I'd recommend is that when you do have your shoes, to track your mileage. Unfortunately, no matter how much we love a pair of running shoes, they don't last forever. So it's important to use a running log and keep up with the amount of mileage that you have on each shoe that you wear for running. And there's a lot of ways you can do this online, or, you know, I actually do it on paper still because that's how I roll.
Well, paper doesn't crash.
Paper doesn't crash.
That's the good news.
Yes. When you can't get online, your paper is still there. Often the insoles of the shoes are good for only around sometimes 300 to 400 miles, while the outsoles may still look good for around 800 miles, you know, if you haven't been doing any off-road in them or mud or anything like that. So you really can't go by how the outside of the shoe looks. The inside of the shoe may be breaking down a bit. So don't go by appearances. Often I'll notice that my legs feel more tired, and I'll realize that the shoes are getting near their retirement age. And if you're a heavier runner or someone who does mostly road running, your shoes are going to wear out more quickly too. Another good way is to look at the bottom of the shoe and look at the wear pattern, because often you'll see that a lot of the sole of the shoe is starting to rub off. So that's a good sign that your shoes need to be replaced. So that's some things to look for when you are looking for a new pair of shoes. I often recommend that people alternate between a couple different pairs of running shoes in their training, especially if they're doing marathon training. That gives the shoes more time to rebound in between runs. It can actually extend the life of your shoes. And having a different brand or model of shoes that you alternate challenges your foot in different ways. So it can actually reduce injury. So that's, you know, something that we've been doing the last few years. And I won't tell you how many pairs of shoes I have in my rotation, but I did restrain myself. I only brought two pairs on our summer trip. So I brought a pair of trail shoes and then my long run shoes.
Me too. I only have two pairs of running shoes that I rotate. My Topos, which I run on the roads, and then I have some Innovates, which I use on trails. And both of them are getting worn out, so I need to be shopping for some new ones.
That's right. And since we talked about trail running and the Appalachian Trail a lot in this episode, we do have a blog post over on our website. It's called 10 Steps to Choosing Trail Shoes. It's an infographic, and it's really helpful for things to think through when you're going to be choosing a pair of trail shoes, especially if you're new to trail running.
So, Angie, you mentioned that you now run in the Ultra Escalante. I just heard that the shoe company Ultra was bought by North Face.
The company that owns North Face, right.
There's always a company that owns a company that owns a company. It's an infinite regress of companies. Anyway, so there are some tips about picking a shoe.
Hopefully that was helpful, Vince.
That's it for this episode. Thanks again to Honest Tea for sponsoring the podcast. For an on-the-go drink, check out Honest Sport. It's made with fair trade ingredients, sea salt for electrolytes, less calories and sugar. Just go to honesttea.com/podcast to check that out. And if you want to get links that were mentioned on this episode, of course, we'll have that with the show notes at marathontrainacademy.com. And while you're there, you can pick up a free handy-dandy resource, downloadable guide called The Runner's Toolbox, 7 Essential Inexpensive Items to Keep Around Your House or Your Camper to Fight and Prevent Running Injury. I say that jokingly, but we actually did bring most of these things.
Unfortunately, the bathtub in our camper is too small for an Epsom salt bath. I could probably soak my feet.
I feel like I haven't had a good shower in like days, you know?
Weeks.
This tiny little camper shower. Anyway, the resource is called The Runner's Toolbox. You can get it when you sign up for our newsletter and also stay up to date on new episodes and content that we publish. Until next time, happy running, and remember, you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Right on my way, right on my way.